Hello and welcome to our Children's Rights in Action podcast series. Here at Children's Parliament, we believe that children should grow up in a world of love, happiness and understanding. Our mission is to inspire greater awareness and understanding of the power of children's human rights and to support the implementation of the United Nations Convention on the Rights of the Child, the UNCRC, into Scots law. We're looking forward to sharing this with you through our conversations. Today we want to focus on how we make children's rights real through the lens of trust.
Hello, Suzanne, and thank you very much for being part of our Year of Childhood, which marks Children's Parliament's 25th birthday and also incorporation of the UNCRC into Scots law. I mean, it's a really lovely synchronicity that to bring our 25th birthday and incorporation, seeing that happen in the same year.
And Kathy, it's also my 10th birthday this very month of the science of connection to the public. So it feels like even more weaving together.
I am delighted
to be here. And I was one of the very first UNFEARTEES.
You were? That's right.
Proud of that.
Well, we were proud to have you, and you're still there shining your light on our website. A key aim of Year of Childhood then is to highlight how a human rights approach supports the development of practice and the emergence of cultures that help to keep children healthy, happy and safe at home, at school and in the community. A few years ago, children worked with us to help us identify the key values that underpin a human rights approach. And the values they came up with were trust, kindness, empathy and respect for each individual's human dignity. And that seemed to us to kind of sum it up. So they became our core values in terms of how we approach and deliver our work. So as part of this series, we're having conversations with colleagues who are respected for work in these areas. And you obviously cover all of them, but today we're going to focus on trust. And you've said, trust is as basic as it comes when thinking about what makes for a good childhood and a good adulthood. So I'm excited to explore this value of trust with you over the next half hour or so. Maybe we could just kick off with you telling us a bit about your background and how you've landed in this place doing this work.
It's a great question, given that I just said it's my 10th birthday. Mm-hmm. I'm really an academic and a research scientist. And I had wanted to do that my whole life. And I came to the University of Dundee in 1993. And I loved it as a developmental psychologist in the School of Psychology. And I was there for nearly 20 years. And in that time, I really came to understand that the science that I loved about how children develop, about the capacities that babies bring with them at birth, about why relationships are so important to healthy development, began to realize that the rest of the public didn't really have access to that information very easily. And I got frustrated because I thought people deserved to know that so that parents could act on it and social workers and teachers and earlier staff and police officers. And so 10 years ago, I took a radical decision and I resigned from my full-time academic post in order to try to reach the public with what I call the science of connection. And I didn't know really how you would do that. It was a real act of trusting the universe, in a sense, if that doesn't sound too strong. But 10 years on, we're still here, and I love it, and I feel honored and excited by every single person who wants to have a conversation about this.
So and congratulations, because clearly you've made a huge impact over the years, and that just seems to grow all the time. And thank goodness you did it, because that leap of faith is you have to be an UNFEARTEE to do that. You have to have an inherent belief and understanding that it makes a difference to make that huge jump. So
I just really thought people deserved to know this. And there was just a real imperative to that. And what I have discovered is people really want to know this stuff. If you make it accessible to them, you put it in language that invites them in rather than feels too big or too scary. And then people get excited and they feel empowered.
Yes.
To build richer, more emotionally attuned relationships. And that's the kind of society that I want to live in.
Yes, and there's a very strong parallel with the human rights work, because that's exactly the same. People, once they get it and see the transformational impact, then they want to be part of it too. But it is about making it accessible and not scary. So let's think about trust specifically then. The building of trust, where does it begin?
Begins in babyhood. By the time you're a year old, you have discovered whether other people are trustworthy or not. And that sounds shocking to lots of people. I mean, when you're a year old, you don't really walk yet. You don't really talk yet. How can you have learned about trusting? And we don't really have conscious memories of that time before we can walk and talk. But what the science of infancy tells us is that it is in those little moments when you feel scared, does someone come and cuddle you? When you feel cold, does someone come and attend to that? When you feel a bit hurt because you tried to get your mom's attention and she didn't give your attention immediately, and does she kind of make up for that? In all those millions of little tiny micro moments, you learn whether the people in your world are paying attention to what you feel. And if they are, then you develop a sense of trust in your body. And if they aren't, then you feel a bit more suspicious, a bit more anxious, a bit more uncertain. And that gets built into your body too. So one of the things that I think is most fascinating about trust is that actually it's biological. It's sometimes we think it's like an idea about other people. It's not. Trust is a biological state. And it feels like safety. And so if we think in terms of what kind of experiences do our children need to have from the time that they are babies, so that they trust other people and they trust the world around them and they trust themselves in that world, then we have a vision for a world that is the kind that I think people want intuitively to give their children, but that is sometimes a little bit challenging and almost radical in terms of some of the changes that would mean that we would need to make in the way we think about children and the way we treat them.
Yes, yes. And I can understand why some people just find it a bit of an esoteric concept. What does it actually mean? So it does help when you break it down and talk about those millions of tiny moments, because it brings it alive, doesn't it?
We live in a culture that has traditionally thought that what you have to do is control children. We don't always use that word, but that's what we mean. When we monitor behavior and we think we have to manage behavior, and we think we need often to punish behavior. So this is where it gets edgy. It's still very common in many schools to have behavior management policies. And if you're interested in children's behavior, but you're not also interested in the feelings that underpin that behavior, then it means you might miss those feelings. And if you miss those feelings, then children don't learn to trust. And as soon as I say that, I think it often makes sense to people, but it also makes us a bit nervous, because then teachers think, well, what would I do to manage a classroom of 30 children if I don't have a behavior management policy? Or parents can think, well, what would I do if I wasn't almost scaring you about what will happen if you don't behave? There are other ways to engage with children. There are other ways to negotiate with them about how we're going to treat each other. But you don't discover those unless you get curious enough to sometimes think beyond what your culture teaches you. And so these insights are both exciting, and they sometimes feel a bit edgy, but I hope that when people hear about them in ways that doesn't make them feel blamed or shamed, that it actually lets them step forward in curiosity. Because I think this is the kind of world people want to create for children.
Yes. So how do you suggest that, what's the best way to go about that, to lay those foundation stones?
It's
what are the key foundation stones that we need to give to ensure that the best opportunity to develop trust and trust in relationships are there?
We need to listen to our children and to each other. Because when you feel heard by other people, That's where you learn to trust them. I need to learn that it's okay if I make mistakes. If I make a mistake, you will still love me. You will still accept me. I might need to make amends for those mistakes, and we might need to talk about it. And we might need to go to apologize to someone else. And I might need to learn that I hurt your feelings. So it doesn't mean that there aren't any things that follow on. There aren't any natural consequences, but it means that you will still love me. I will still feel included. I will still feel welcomed, even if there are difficulties and even if I make a mistake. Mm-hmm. That means that repair is possible after a rupture. And there's this really fascinating scientific concept called the rupture repair cycle that we now know is central to this development of trust. Really healthy relationships are based not in because things don't go wrong, not because people don't get tetchy with each other, fall out, make mistakes. You don't need to prevent that in order to have healthy relationships. Healthy relationships come from the repair of difficult moments. Some children grow up in families or schools or settings where they don't experience repair. Because for some people, it's hard to say sorry. And often we don't know how important it is to pay attention to those feelings. And what we now know is that it is the lack of repair that causes lasting damage. And so another thing we can do to just to put in place that platform you just asked about is to focus on making up, on saying sorry, on checking in on how people are feeling. If someone tells you something that's a bit uncomfortable, like your child, tuning in and saying, tell me more about how you feel that way, rather than you're not allowed to say that, or rather than it doesn't matter that you feel that. And sometimes the courage that's attached to that is that, you know, sometimes people say things to you, your children say things to you that are not always comfortable to hear. If we can say things to each other, even when they're a bit difficult to hear, that is where trust lies. And the world, options open up in the kind of world that we can create together. And if we can say that, if we go much bigger, if systems could say to the people they're meant to serve, we're sorry that we got it wrong. If leaders could say, we tried that, but it didn't work. If we could have more repair, both at the big levels and the smaller levels, then we would have a healthier world. So these principles are not just about individuals and individual families. They're also about our public systems and our organizations as well.
Yes, and this culture that you reference in this one of control, and I'll often talk about a culture of reward and punishment, is about, you know, adults feeling that they have to be in control, that they have full responsibility to make everything work. And I think teachers have such a lot of pressure on them to know everything, to be the answer to all of life's big problems. And that pressure and that even having conversations about how to change it and make it different is difficult, isn't it?
Wouldn't it be amazing if we had a world where we had less anxious adults? And we had systems that didn't create anxious adults. Now that will sound like a utopian to some people, but if you do not first dream it, how can you create it?
Yeah.
Because when you start to realize that we live in a culture that seeks to control children, to manage their behavior, first of all, that's kind of hard for some people to go, what do you mean by that? Because it's so common that people don't even see it. Mm-hmm. But what it means is that we don't trust our own children, right? So we don't trust children to play and to learn. So we think we have to manage all their learning, and the education system conveys the message that you are in charge of children's learning. Well, if you take child-led play, children are learning. They are learning the things that interest them and motivate them, which drives them to want to learn new things. Mm. So the idea that we don't trust our children, as is an intriguing one. Okay, but then we don't trust parents either. So lots of systems think you have to control parents, think you have to reinterpret parents' experiences for them. So we have a debate going on in the country at the moment about deferral from primary one. There are systems that are fighting with parents rather than having parents feel heard so that parents trust the system. And as soon as I bring that example, in my head right now, I'm thinking, I wonder if Kathy wanted to go there. I wonder if that feels too edgy to Children's Parliament to talk about something that is simply going on in our country at the moment. Mm-hmm. I just think things should be named, even when they are uncomfortable.
Because
once we name them, and that too is part of building trust, we can name what we feel.
And we can have a conversation because you have to, I think, there's something about dismantling some of that conversation because it feels a bit sometimes as if we go around in circles that we give parents the message that school is where children learn. So parents can often be advocates who want children to be starting school early because they think it's better for their children's academic progress. We know that's not true, but it's very difficult to have that conversation in a conversation that becomes quite challenging and difficult, and there isn't a lot of room for listening in it, and people quite quickly take sides.
And so from that, we've used this word control and we've used the word punishment. One more word that helps us to understand some of what we're up against is power. Mm. So we have a really hierarchical culture where professionals often have power over parents, and systems have power over the people who work in their systems, like teachers, and parents have power over children. Now, I don't mean that we don't need structure, but if our relationships are based on power, then what that means is I don't have to listen to how you feel, and that doesn't build trust.
Yeah.
Once you start to get interested in trust, it starts to weave together a different way of relating to each other, and it means that even if there is mess, even if there are difficult moments, we have ways of talking about that, of sorting that out, of repairing, of listening. And we get better at that because we practice being in that mess. And yeah. Our systems want procedures that just do away with that mess. Trust is a way of being in the mess and still not losing touch with each other.
Yes. And I've got a good example maybe of a colleague's recently were talking about working with very young children, and the children were saying lots of really interesting, useful things through the positive relationship that they built with them. But as soon as they asked them to repeat what they said on camera, what the children said changed because they felt that they had to give the right answer that their teachers would expect. And that's about, I'm not suggesting that it's not about trusting their teachers, but it was about they didn't trust themselves that their opinion was important and valuable, and trust that that would be received in a way that would be respected.
And so when you go back to, okay, so trust is about trusting other people, and therefore if you trust other people enough and you have enough of those experiences, then you kind of trust the world, right? So you expect that good things will happen to you in the world rather than being anxious about the world. And then that affects your body so that you're at a kind of higher stress level all the time, which is the point of trauma and adverse childhood experiences. One of the fascinating things is that if you learn as a baby that other people are trustworthy, then you inevitably learn that you are also trustworthy to yourself.
Yeah.
And if you learn that other people are not trustworthy, then you can't learn how to trust yourself, your own what your body is telling you, what feels comfortable for you, what doesn't feel comfortable for you, what you're allowed to say no to. I just think there's something profound that the science really helps us to understand, that in the way you relate to me is how I also learn to relate to myself. And then when we get that idea, we better understand the nature of trauma. So the reason that I am having difficulty saying no to other people, or I'm a people pleaser, or I need to keep myself emotionally distant from other people, is because I haven't learned to feel comfortable in me, in knowing me, trust myself, so that I can then negotiate those boundaries with you. So we, as human beings, are so social that who we experience ourselves to be comes out of who other people, how other people treated me, how I experienced myself in your presence.
Yeah. And so if we think about children who don't have these positive early baby and early childhood experiences, these are often the children, I think, who are continually in that process of experiencing rupture through their lives, because they haven't managed to get to a place where they feel comfortable and confident and behave in a way that's acceptable and expected of them. So for children who don't experience that, what can we as adults, what do we need to do to help mitigate some of that? What can we do to make sure that we don't make it any worse, that, you know?
Kathy, it's a great question. Can I start with curiosity? When other people frustrate you, when children frustrate you, if you can move to a place of curiosity and think, what is going on inside your body? Are you stressed? Lots of people now use that phrase, what happened to you, instead of what is wrong with you. That's a curiosity place. If you can move into curiosity, it puts you in a different place in relation to that person. Then the second thing you can do is get people to talk about their feelings more, right? So sometimes the phrase is now used, connect before you correct. So renew your connection before you talk about what went wrong, because you're
related. That's a great one. I love that. Yeah.
You can use words that help you to remember that sometimes other people struggle in ways that are inconvenient for you. So Patuca East Primary School has made a real reputation for themselves by one language change. They shifted the language of challenging behavior to distressed behavior. And they now use that throughout the school. And I have told that story for years now, because it's a really simple thing that parents can do, the families can do, the schools can do. And it moves the adults into a place that goes, okay, so rather than exhibiting challenging behavior, you are demonstrating distressed behavior. And if you're distressed, you need me to move in and help. And so it puts the adult in a different starting place. And if you step in with help, it changes the behavior of the child in front of you. And what you often learn is that there's a story of sadness, of frustration, of anxiety, of grief, of loss, of distrust that is underpinning that behavior. If children don't learn that other people will listen to them, the adults will listen to them, that the parents will listen to them, that there's a teacher who will listen to them, that their social worker listens to them. If they don't learn that in childhood, then you get to adulthood with an unconscious belief that you are not worth being listened to. And therefore, you don't have a very trustworthy stance to the world. And therefore, I'm just trying to help the adults who are listening to this to understand how powerful they are. You might be the person who helps a child to understand there is someone trustworthy in the world, and they haven't ever experienced that before. Now, it might be a bit hard because their behavior might be a bit pushy. It might be a bit inconvenient. You might need to work really hard at staying in a curious place. But if you understand that is your power, then I think that helps us to have, you know, more stick to it energy. Because if you don't, if a child doesn't trust and grow into an adult who doesn't trust, then you're just going back to your what feels familiar, and you're trying to help them to get to a different way of relating to the world. If you're trying to help them to learn that some people in the world are trustworthy. So in other words,
yeah,
it's about you. It's about their struggles, and you can help with that.
And you showed, and it was on recently on telly, the full program of Ian Wright. You showed a clip in one of your presentations. It's so powerful, isn't it?
Ian Wright, who everybody knows is a footballer. It turns out he had a childhood full of trauma that he didn't talk about at the time. So many of his teachers won't have known. They'll have been frustrated with him. And he tells the story of one particular teacher who really helped him to feel valued and heard. But part of the point of that story is the teacher did not think he was doing anything special. He was just being with Ian Wright. So rather than doing to, if we can be with, that creates trust. And can I add, that is challenging in today's world. We live in a world that is really anxious and scary for lots of us. Social media is full of people who fight, and it isn't a very good place for listening. We were scared to go outside before COVID. So we're scared of the strangers on the street. We don't know who everybody is. We're scared of traffic. You know, not that many years ago, children walked to school on their own. You know, there's the old stories about, you know, your mom chucked you out your door at 8 o'clock. She chucked some jelly pieces out the window at 12. And she said, you know, didn't he come home till your tea? Children don't live that kind of life anymore. Mm. And so we began to realize that more fear is built into our world and therefore our bodies. So choosing to actively trust and to focus on trust creates a sense of safety in our bodies. And it becomes a radical act in this world. But I think that is the kind of world so many of us are trying to build. That's what a trauma-informed world is. It's a world that we trust, in which we trust and in which we feel safe. And the idea that that begins even when you're a baby kind of puts that lifespan into some sort of perspective.
And I think that's why we're so excited about incorporation of the United Nations Convention on the Rights of the Child, because, you know, there are two ways to look at it. One way is that it's a stick to beat people with. And it's to say, well, you don't have the option of not treating children with respect, not putting trust and empathy and kindness at the heart of your relationships. This is now the law. Or we can help, as you're doing, help adults understand that is the law. And these are expectations that we all now have a duty to fulfill. But if you don't believe it, fake it. And by faking it, you will see the difference. You'll see the impact that you can have as an adult. And just by doing that, you will be making sure that you're upholding children's human rights, which too many people in Scotland are still terrified of because they think it means children are going to get what they want. But you've spoken about consequences. And of course, you know, we all have social responsibilities, every single individual on the planet. But it is about children needing systems and structures and boundaries, but it's doing it with trust, kindness, empathy, human dignity at its heart, I guess, isn't it?
Can you imagine that? Imagine a world in which you can have boundaries and structure and natural consequences, but that aren't based in fear and anxiety and proper behavior, but that are based in trust, are based in kindness, are based in respect, are based in keeping connected even when we have difficult moments. I think what the UNCRC is a discussion about what kind of world do we want to have. We have had those discussions before in our country. So if we look back in history, once upon a time, we had the kind of world where poor children went up chimneys in order to clear out the chimneys for middle-class families. The Industrial Revolution depended on putting children up chimneys. We don't have that kind of world now. And once upon a time, you know, some key leaders at that point thought, I don't want to live in that kind of world. I'm going to work for a world where children don't go up chimneys. Once upon a time, we had a world where children could be belted in school. In the 1970s and 80s, we had a discussion. Not everybody agreed with it, but a whole lot of people said, I don't want to live in a world where we belt children. Once upon a time, in the 1950s, we had a world where if your child went to hospital, parents couldn't stay with you and you left children scared in hospital. And some people fought for that and said, I don't want a world where children's parents can't stay when they're scared in hospital. So I think there's something about telling those historic stories of the past when you realize that in the past we have had conversations about what kind of world do we want to build? We're having that again. And a lot of people want to have a world where children have a right to expect respect and kindness and empathy. And I want to live in that kind of world. I'm willing to work for it. And I'm really glad that there are so many other people who want that world as well, because that's what will give us the world that will let us sustain happy, healthy lives. That's the world I want. And I think that's what the UNCRC lets us have a conversation about. And I'm so glad that Children's Parliament and so many others have pushed so hard to have that be embedded in law.
Yeah, and it's what is also great is that children want all this too. You know, they want to be, they're our allies. They want to be on this bus and drive, you know, driving the bus alongside us.
So let's have a conversation about what that world might look like. And rather than paying attention to the things that make us scared of it, and I know some people are scared, and I agree, some of it's going to take some rethinking. So some of it might be a bit messy. But if we could sit down and have conversations about what would the world look like, our world, what would Scotland look like if that was the kind of vision we had for the society we wanted to create, for the kind of country we wanted to be? What would that look like? Well, first we need to talk about it. And first we need to dream it. And let's envision it and pay attention to what is possible rather than what scares us. Mm-hmm. So that's why these conversations and this series is so valuable. It helps us have exactly those conversations.
Perfect. Well, that's the next step. And we look forward to being on it with you, Suzanne. Thank you so much for today. You're inspirational. Your work's amazing. We will do whatever we can to support you too. And I look forward to what is coming down the line over the next few months and years with embedding the UNCRC across children's lives at home, at school, and in the community.
Kathy, I'm just delighted to be part of a whole big choir of people who are singing exactly this song. Thank you.
Yeah. Today. Thank you.
Thank you ever so much for listening to today's episode. If you'd like to learn more about our work, please visit www.childrensparliament.org.uk.